And now for another amazing episode of the Pop Zara podcast.
Okay, great. Now try and aim for this target right here.
Target.
This thing right here, that is a target.
Okay, right here.
Yes.
Great, great. Now try and get it back up to the top.
Okay.
No,
that's okay. You still got an extra 100 points.
No, but it went down the hole.
The drain? Yeah, sure. It's always going to do that.
I wanted to win.
Well, you can't win pinball. It's just about having fun.
You're like a kid in an adult bookstore.
Well, I promise from here on out, I'll be incredibly predictable and boring.
Sounds awful.
You want to go again?
Yes.
Hello and welcome back to the Pop Zara podcast. Today we're talking about amusement parks. We're talking about video game movies because it seems that 2023 might be the year that the much maligned video game movie adaptation or television series breaks the curse. We've had already hits like The Last of Us. We have a Tetris movie coming out. What about pinball? Pinball's not a video game, you say, but it's kind of the hissing cousin of video games. And there is a film out. You can get it right now. You can stream it right now. The movie is called Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game. Joining us on the podcast are the writer, director, slash writing duo brothers of the movie, Austin Bragg and Meredith Bragg. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Oh, man. A little behind the scenes. We were having a lot of fun before we started recording about all our influences. And I'm going to try to bring back that joy a little bit, because I think just talking with you guys for 2 minutes made me realize why I like this movie so much. And I just want to say, for anybody who might be curious about whether or not the pinball film is actually a documentary or a biopic, it's kind of a little bit of both, but a little bit of not. I don't know how to describe it, why don't I let the creators describe? How did you guys go from the inspiration of, it's Roger Tharp, right?
Roger Sharp.
Sorry, my mind's not working today because I'm still thinking about pinball. So it is the story that follows Roger Sharp, the man who had a incidental moment in the history of pinball that helped legalize the game across the country. Not the most exciting premise, but it makes for a terribly entertaining film. So how did we go from anecdote to film?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I initially cold emailed Roger. We're not sure where we first saw the photo of Roger, and I'll tell all your listeners to Google this, Google Roger Sharp pinball shot. There's this shot of famous photo of Roger, famous in pinball circles, of him playing pinball in this New York City Council chambers, proving that it's a game of skill and not chance, and helping to overturn the ban that had been in place for about 35 years there. We're not sure where we first came across that photo or the story of Roger, but we put it in a Google Doc where we have a bunch of ideas that we occasionally dig through when we're looking for our next project. And I happened to come across it February 2020. I cold emailed Roger, got on the phone with him, and about 3 hours later, I called Austin and I said, hey, I think this might be a feature. We weren't sure if it was going to be just a doc or a short or anything at all. Sometimes these cold emails never pan out. But he had told me about everything else that was happening around his life at that time, and a much more universal story than just what he will affectionately call a footnote of pinball history.
As we described in the review for the film, guys, Roger is like notoriously dismissive of his title as the man who saved pinball. And I think we should spoil a little bit about the film, is that the title itself is a little bit of hyperbolic exaggeration, a little bit, which I think if you know that going in, you're going to understand sort of the rhythm I think you guys were going for with this film. And first of all, let me just say, this is a very funny movie. This is very funny. This is not a biographical slog. This is not a History Channel recreation. You know, you're not going to learn about Typhoid Mary and about the insistence of how pinball is necessary to get people through the toils of the Depression. It's a very funny movie that skips over a lot to get to where I think you're trying to get to. Would that be appropriate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in a lot of ways we set this up as Roger's story, you know, present day Roger telling his story. And he is rather dismissive of what he accomplished.
Before we started recording, we were sort of spitballing other films that use the narrative structure of the pinball film. And we can go through that again, because that was a lot of fun. But another one that came to me was, people would ask, why pinball? Why are we talking about the creation of pinball? And I think if you know the game, if you understand a little bit, then you understand that there's two stories at play in your film. But it was reminding me of, I think it came out in 2008. There was a movie about the creation of the windshield wiper called Flash of Genius.
With Greg Kinnear, right?
Yeah, with Greg Kinnear. And, you know, we could talk about the Hudsucker proxy and the hula hoop. We could talk about so many things. And you realize that it's not necessarily pinball itself, but it's pinball as the starting point to find the very human story that's at play here. And I will not spoil what I think you guys are going for. But I think anybody who watches will understand that if I say this is about the greatest shot that Roger took, you would understand that completely after finishing the film and the journey that it took him to get there. And again, I think it's fantastic. At least a fantastic starting point for something that could have gone very differently in different hands. And
thank you.
Well, I do want to say, though, if I'm being nebulous here, that the way that you guys have structured the film, have written and structured it, is that it's a film with very an erratic narrative, I would call it. It sets itself up as a biographical documentary, and then it keeps interrupting itself. And you have the older Roger played by, oh, my goodness, one of my favorite character actors. I don't know how you guys got him. I'm very, very happy. Oh, how do you pronounce his name? Is it Dennis Boutsakaris?
Yeah.
Boutsakaris, you got it. Yep.
We were extremely lucky that Dennis came on board. He was actually one of Roger Sharp's recommendations.
Really?
And after, you know, maybe, 10 minutes on a Zoom call, we were already making fun of each other. So we knew that it was going to work out.
Well, and of course, the younger Roger is played by the great Mike Feist, who's having quite a year, having quite a career beginning of himself, being in West Side Story, and now, of course, having the best mustache that I've ever seen.
Deservedly so. Mike was such a fantastic addition to the cast.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about a guy who could do anything at this point that he wants. And he was in every single scene almost in this film for the entire shoot. And he was just a dream to work with. Everybody loved Mike.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should also say that no spoilers here, but Dennis is in much of those scenes as well with Mike, playing the same character in different time zones, that you have the older Roger interacting with his own memories or as a, you know, personal spectator, which to me is just catnip. But when you see people having fun with narrative like that, I think it just draws you in, and I think it helps create like a protective layer that you think to yourself, yeah, these guys are taking my history seriously, so I'm not going to take it as seriously, and I'm going to have a little fun with it. And I think one of my favorite scenes in the movie was at the very beginning, when obviously there's a height disparity between Dennis and Mike, and you guys just said, screw it, just go with it. You have to get a bite. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but it's very funny. It's very clever.
Well, we had at the beginning of this process, we had set up with MPI Original Films that we wanted to make this story into a feature. And then Roger was sort of hesitant, because I think anytime someone says, we want to make a movie about your life and it's going to be a comedy, you should probably think once or twice about that. So we sat down and we spent a lot of time with Roger. This was our sort of pandemic project. So 2020, when everything was locked down, I was in my basement on Zoom with Roger and Meredith. And that sort of push and pull over the course of the year, as we, you know, discovered all these things going on in his life, really sort of defined the way we approached the script, I think. The push and pull between Roger and the directors and how this movie is going to go.
But we also, as far as that particular scene that you just mentioned, I think audiences, they want to come into a movie enjoying it. And you have a lot of leeway in those first 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, where you're setting up the ground rules, giving everyone an idea of what this film's going to be and what the characters are. So we knew we needed to sort of explain pretty early on that Roger and Mr. Sharp are going to be in the same place. They're going to be Mr. Sharp's going to be commenting on things, but also on the fact that we're making a movie. There's this artifice there, this the film, and he's going to be routinely able to make his judgments known as to how the directors are doing. And we just thought it was fun. We like that sort of meta stuff. So it was a fun device for us to play with. And I don't know, most of this time when Austin and I are writing, I swear 70% of it is just trying to get the other person to laugh. So this was a fun way to do that. And the real trick was figuring out what's the right proportion? Because we had a lot of jokes where you could constantly have Dennis as Mr. Sharp coming in and poking fun. But at a certain point, you need to focus on the story and not just on the meta analysis. So figuring out where we should have him pipe in, that was probably the biggest challenge, and sort of how much in the beginning versus the end. And because we sort of knew what we wanted to do. And again, we're not going to necessarily spoil anything here, though. I think everyone knows that you can now play pinball in New York City. So he did save the game. But we knew we wanted him at the end. And the question was, at what point we sort of wanted audiences to somewhat forget about him a little bit, so that when it did, the impact would be that much harder. But thank you. I enjoyed that moment a lot.
Well, I think also what it does, I mentioned before that you have glimpses about what this film might have been in different hands. And I think, I don't know if you both did this intentionally or not, but when you have scenes, for example, let's just call it what it is, the most chaste, the most romantic, the most innocent scene ever set in a porn store that I've ever seen in a film. I know that sounds a little crazy, but can I just say this? Let me qualify this. We just had a movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once, a film that featured two dildo fights, mm-hmm. win Best Picture.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. In an IRS office.
In an IRS office. And butt plugs. And yet it sounds terrible on paper, but when you watch it, it's almost innocent in its execution, except for even the butt plugs.
I would say that's also, as far as our porn shop, that's the most G-rated adult bookstore that has ever existed on film, I imagine.
The only thing pornographic about that scene is his mustache. but when you watch the film, you know, there's that, I'm not going to spoil it for the audience, but there's the scene when you think it's going one way, it's going to become ghost with pinballs. And then it becomes something else. And you guys repeat this mechanism over and over to the point where I know, like, you're getting glimpses of what a Hollywood Spielbergian version of this movie would have been. It would have been crowds cheering. It would have been exaggerations. It would have been this. It would have been that. But then going back to the pinball scene, this is the part that made me really fall in love with the film, is that you have this relationship between two adults who are dorky, who are innocent, who really love each other, but they're not exaggerating that affection for each other. They're just having conversations about it. You know, you have characters that are examining their flaws, and you think to yourself, and I think the film makes a commentary itself, that I thought this film was about pinball, but it's about pinball as much as Rocky's about boxing. Oh, goodness. What's the movie with the baseball movie, The Natural, you know, with Robert Redford, or Field of Dreams? It's the sport itself. The game itself is just an in to the relationship. And that's what I think the genius of it is. It could have been a very different film.
Well, part of that probably stems from the fact that we are not pinball people. We did not come at this as pinball people. So while we were very much we wanted to create something that the pinball community could embrace, we also wanted something that anyone could watch. And so I think because we were not pinball people at that time, we sort of had an outsider's perspective. For some pinball people, they may have wanted more pinball, but we were trying to...
It's never enough for them.
Never enough. But at the same time, others wanted more relationship. Like, you know, you can't make a movie for everyone, but figuring out what that balance was important to us.
And important to Roger, too. Right? I mean, there's only so much that we can do writing and directing. Mike and Crystal were phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were so good. I don't know. They really sold it for me. Their chemistry was just fantastic.
Yeah, we can write the lines and we can hope the chemistry is there, but that's up to the actors. And they had a lot of fun playing and riffing off each other. And mm-hmm. we definitely gave them a lot of latitude to sort of experiment. We didn't have a ton of time, so they weren't given a lot of takes. Yeah. So they really used those takes to play, and mm-hmm. the chemistry is all them. They're awesome.
Well, the writing helps. I think anybody who's just listening to the film, even if you're not watching, there's an honesty, I think, in the dialogue that I don't know. I'm not going to assume here, but I don't know how much of that was given to you by Roger or how much of that is an invention. But either way, it's for the purposes of the film, it's very natural. It's very funny and it's very quippy. And I think, you know, as a society, when we go to the film, when we go to the movies, we are completely bombarded with blockbusters over and over where you have, I don't know who, I forget who mentioned it, might have been Tarantino or it might have been Scorsese. It's always Scorsese commenting on Marvel films. But it's like, you know, the comment was, how come everybody in a superhero film has to act like a teenager? How come they always talk like a teenager? And you have these two characters that are just talking to each other in a film that's very funny, but also based on real life. And it's a breath of fresh air, I think, when you get to be a certain age and you just want to hear something like that in a film, but not have it sort of dressed in angst and not have it dressed in, you know, nihilism and death. It's, we've had too many films like that, where if it's not mean-spirited, that it's not good writing. And I think that's not the case here. I think it's both. It's fun, it's innocent, but it's also very well written.
Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, it's a movie about pinball. If it's not fun, we've done something terribly wrong.
Well, I think, you know, one of my favorite lines in the film is when you have older Roger, and they're getting into the cab, and he comments about LaGuardia Airport. And, you know, he gives the quip about LaGuardia, you know, no spoilers, but there is a scene in the film where you actually do buckle down and you talk about pinball. You know, I don't know if it's a homework assignment or not, but it's fun. It's documentary style. And, you know, it's referenced a few times about LaGuardia, you know, banning the game in New York and this and that. But, you know, I think the line he says is, you know, what was it? LaGuardia Airport was built on the remnants of an amusement park. I mean, even in death, the man hated fun. It's, mm-hmm. That's very clever. It's very fun. So it's, you don't really hear that a lot.
Well, I think we said it pretty explicitly. It's difficult to make a movie when you're, you know, the bad guy is not only dead, but has an airport named after him and is, you know, consistently on the list of New York's best mayors of all time, right? This is our bad guy. So good choice.
Well, I mean, going back to the structure, though, we were chatting a little bit before. The movie is very unconventional. It breaks narrative convention. It breaks sound convention. It breaks all conventions to tell its story. We had the review go up today, and I think one of you mentioned, you know, I'll forgive you, but you had never heard of the film Pirates of Silicon Valley. Well, that's definitely a bucket list type of thing. But for those who don't know, it's a film that came out on TNT years and years ago. The structure is very similar in the fact that you have characters interacting with their old selves, specifically the voice actor John DiMaggio, you know, Bender from Futurama. He plays Mike Ballmer, and he'll go back and interact with his own memories. And I've always been a stickler for this because I think it's very cinematic in that instead of just telling you a story, it shows how cinema can interact with itself and tell a better story. And to be fair, guys, I don't really see that narrative at play very much. It's usually just voiceovers and it's flashbacks. It's people don't seem to know how to have fun with it anymore, which is sad. Pirates of Silicon Valley isn't the only one. I think we were mentioning other films like American Splendor. Forgive me, guys. What was the other one you mentioned too? There was
Futile and Stupid Gesture.
Oh yeah, the right? National Lampoon one on Netflix. Yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of fun too. But no, it's so. What made you decide to approach the material like that?
Well, to be honest, I don't think we had any of those references when we were writing this. Mm-mm. It's not something I had seen American Splendor when it came out, but I had frankly forgotten about it and should probably go back and rewatch it to see, you know, if I unintentionally stole something. But our biggest reference point, I think, was actually Princess Bride.
Really?
Yes, because Princess Bride has that structure of the story being told and the kid stopping the story occasionally and talking through it, mm-hmm. and talking about it, and then they go back into it. And then you have that relationship of the grandfather and the grandson transform through the film. So it changed by the end. And that was something we talked about a lot. I could tell you a couple weeks before we started shooting, we had hired our DP and we were talking about John Kang, who was great. And we were talking with him and he said, have you seen, was it A Stupid and Futile Gesture? Is that what it's called, Austin?
Yeah. Futile and Stupid Gesture, I think.
And we hadn't. So we watched it and then we thought, oh no,
yeah, we're in trouble.
We thought we had stumbled on something unique, and it just goes to show you that there's nothing new in this world. Things, you know, it's so you just do the best you can and you hope that your imprint on it will make it different and unique, that, you know, you can't help but have it. Even if you try to go and make something, you know, shot for shot remake, I think, you know, Psycho is a good example. It's different. It's going to be different. It's going to feel different. You can't do it. It will always have the imprints of, you know, the writers, the directors, the cast, the crew, so it became something unique and different. But no, we actually didn't talk about any of those films or their structure. This was something that we felt would help based on the conversations we had with Roger. Yeah, Austin?
But we knew we were telling an old story from a newer perspective, right? We knew we were telling a light story that's sort of, you know, breezy. It should be fun. And yet we know that we're also shooting in 70s New York City. So we weren't going to do, you know, the gritty 70s look. We weren't doing Disco. We weren't doing Taxi Driver, right? New York in the 70s was not a great place.
Fear City.
And yet we're telling this happy, fun pinball movie. So we knew that, you know, there's no smoking in our movie, right? Which obviously was everywhere in New York in the 70s. There's lots of things like that where we knew that we were taking not a revisionist take, but sort of a nostalgic look back, as opposed to a realistic one. And I think that that dynamic that's built in with the narrator works that way.
Yeah.
Well, as far as influence, I mean, I think everything's probably influenced by like the Christmas Carol anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, like there may not be any new ideas under the sun, but there's still different, you know, there's different ways to show them. And so, but I will say this, you guys both took the correct narrative approach. I think it's engaging and I think it's a lot of fun. And I think I wish more films would have just take chances with that and just trust the audience to go along with it. I think they would be rewarded richly instead of just having by the numbers. I don't know. Have either of you guys seen the trailer for the new Tetris film that's coming out?
I have.
Yeah, there's car chases in there and everything. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, the pinball movie could have been very different. Very different. You could have found that angle. You could have found the excitement. No, I think the approach was appropriate. I think it works.
Well, now you're making me think that we should have just gone Taken with it and had Liam Neeson fight to get his pinball machine back after it's raided by the cops.
I should say, I think, you know, in some ways, I know one review mentioned, you know, that in some ways it's strange that pinball came out before Tetris and Air and Blackberry and these other films, because it looks like it's almost a meta commentary on those movies. But the truth is, I love those movies. And that's one of the reasons that I really like, I mean, I'm gently making, think we sort of gently make fun of the form and the way that Hollywood will take these true stories and you know, play with them. Embellish and play with the narrative, but I don't know. I love that stuff. So I mean, it's I'm definitely not making fun of them so much. If I am, it's from a place of love because I deeply enjoy those movies.
You could especially definitely. The ones that, go ahead. I was going to say you could definitely make an action-oriented pinball movie. All you'd have to do is say inspired by the real story. That's the get out of jail free card. It's just as long as something's inspired, you know, you could have anything. Liam Neeson in there as Roger.
So. Yeah, it sounds like Pinball 2 is writing itself. Yeah.
Pinball 2. but again, I don't know if either have either of you guys seen the new History of the World Part 2 on Hulu?
Not. I'm a big fan of Part 1, but I have not seen Part 2.
Well, I won't spoil it for many reasons, but the narrative structure is a little similar in that you have Mel Brooks come back and he only narrates. He does not interact with any, he does not star, he does not interact or anything. And I think, well, of course, he's, what, 95 years old, so it's probably a logical reason. But I think going back to the narrative structure you guys took, I think what it does, like I said, it does allow the viewer to experience exactly what I think the central story is, which isn't necessarily about pinball itself, but about how, again, I mentioned this before, how this specific game changed this one man's life and how it gave him, you know, no spoilers, the confidence to go for something. And I think in our review for it, we did mention, I think I'm the one who wrote it. I don't know anymore. But we mentioned, you know, I compared a little bit to the movie Rocky Balboa. You know, there's a very famous line in the film and, you know, about where Rocky castigates his son for being cowardly. And, you know, very famous. Now, I think it's become sort of a meme with Rocky fans. But, you know, the quote is, life is not about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. And in pinball, of all movies, you have a very similar line where Roger says, the ball is going to drain no matter what you do. It's about what you do, you know, it's about how you take the shot. And I never in my wildest dreams would have ever thought I'd have like an inspirational Rocky moment from a movie about pinball. But it makes sense. But it does make sense when I think you see the way the film sort of structures itself.
It also makes sense when you talk to Roger. I mean, Roger has a deep passion for the game. He really does feel a connection, you know, not just to individual machines, but to the game as a whole, to the industry as a whole, to that community. I think anytime you talk to somebody about their passions, you can sort of get swept up into it. It's real easy to find that analog in your own life where, you know, you feel that way.
I mean, Roger said to us that people think about him saving Pinball. That's how they talk about it. You know, Roger saved Pinball, but in his mind, Pinball rescued him. And it gave him a life that he otherwise would never have had, just in some ways, you know, by chance, by meeting certain people that he wouldn't have. He talks about if it had been legal in New York, then he would have just played pinball and he would have continued to be, you know, a journalist, or maybe he would have been in advertising. You know, he's not sure, but he would never have met the people. He would have never tried to get his own game. He never would have written the first book on pinball like that. So it's amazing how a small thing, a small, sometimes chance accident, can end up being a huge inflection point in someone's life.
I'm at the Popstar website, we do cover video games and film quite a bit. So, and you know, the sort of the intersectionality of that. So I think pinball fits quite well in there. But I don't know, have either of you guys ever been to an arcade in New Hampshire called Fun Spot? It's considered the largest arcade in the world, and it's the home of the pinball championships. And I was actually there randomly a couple of years ago visiting some family. Didn't realize the arcade was there, and I went there. And I believe they film part of the movie The King of Kong. You know, the film about the Donkey Kong thing, sure. With, you know, which did have a bad guy, which actually did have its own villain. But, you know, you go there and you see this collection of pinball. And even if you don't understand why pinball means so much to people, you can get the sense of why it means so much to people, that there's such a community there that's very, very supportive of each other and very, very intermingled with each other. If that means anything. And I think, again, going back to the film, I think what you did is I think you added just enough of that fandom, just enough of that excitement to make it palatable to people who may not be already there on the ground level, which I think is important if you're making a movie about pinball.
Yeah, that was absolutely part of the equation beforehand, is making sure that these themes are universal and these stories, you know, you can get into even having never played a pinball game in your life. I will say that the pinball community was fantastic on this film. We had to source, 25, 30 different vintage machines, some of them very specific, and all of which had to look like they're relatively new. And it was a pretty serious undertaking. And people were driving trucks with their own machines, five, six machines in the back, and unloading them and setting them up just so we could film. I mean, there were some really fantastic people out there who helped us along.
Speaking of that, the key moment, I'm not going to talk, I won't reveal it, but there's a moment when Roger shows, you know, the fictional Roger shows off his collection. Was that the real Roger's collection, or was that just a sort of a amalgamation of what his collection looked like?
That was a set. We were not in Roger Sharp's basement, but all of those machines were sourced by Roger. All of those machines in the basement mean something to Roger for one reason or another.
And also, the prop, I just have to know, because there's a scene when the fictional Roger shows off the actual book, you know, the pinball exclamation mark book. That book, I looked it up, that book is going for $5,000 online. Have you seen? That's insane.
Yeah, the hardcover is, it's been out of print for a while. 5,000 is a little crazy, but I think you can find cheaper versions out there. We have the paperback.
I'm in the wrong business if I'm not investing in books these days. But no, it's really interesting. But before we get going, I just want to make a comment real quick. So I watched this film with my roommate, and she's someone who's not very, wouldn't know a bumper from a flipper, from a tilt. You know, she wouldn't know the first thing about pinball, but there were moments in the movie she was crying. And I asked, what's wrong? She's like, it's, and she kept saying to me, it's so sweet. It's so sweet. And this is the big question. On the surface, a movie about pinball would seem very masculine. It would seem very, it would gear towards a certain demographic. But I think after watching the film, this might be almost a perfect date film. And I'm not trying to get you guys settled in a genre, but how much of the writing process was intentional about making this story as accessible for as many people as possible?
You know, I think it just came out naturally. I don't think we meant to write a rom-com when we first started. I knew we knew that there's going to be sort of a sports story element to all this. But I think it came naturally by talking with, you know, Roger and all the people, you know, around Roger. And that at the, you know, it lent itself to a sort of, I don't want to say it's a complete twist ending, but an interesting ending at the end, and sort of reverse engineer it, sort of, okay, you know, we like to both set up expectations and then maybe twist it a little bit at the end of the film. We think, you know, it's satisfying, but not necessarily something you immediately see coming. Or if you do, maybe not in the way that we handle it. I have two daughters, 9 and 12. It's nice to make something they can see and watch. So that may have been part of, you know, the back of my mind. There is a relationship with an 11-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. That's if not at the heart of the movie, it's there. It's definitely a major part of the movie. And it just started feeling like, I think when you think about pinball, it's today it feels like a family activity. So it felt like creating something that a family could watch seemed important. Yeah, but I don't think we ever set out. I think our stuff tends to go a little bit more dark comedy route. Traditionally, these stories end up becoming what they're supposed to be. And this is what it was supposed to be, you know, a little bit, a knowing comedy that had a sort of a romantic heart at its core that may be a little surprising, but with a little history, true history sprinkled in.
And I think it's very successful. And I think that might be a good place to sort of wrap this up. And I was going to say that for anybody who might be interested, even if you don't think that the game of pinball is your forte, even if you think you're a diehard Super Mario fan and you can't wait to see the film, I think Pinball, the Man Who Saved the Game, is something that you should make time for on any streaming network, because it is available now. And I want to thank our very special guests on this episode of the Pop Star Podcast, filmmakers Austin Bragg and Meredith Bragg. Gentlemen, thank you very much once again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Pop Zara Podcast. Remember to like, follow, share, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app or service.